And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's July 30th, which is the 211th day of the year. 212th in leap years. In the Gregorian calendar. Only 154 days left until the end of the year. Well, in the year 762, Baghdad is founded. 1419, first defenestration of Prague. A crowd of radical Hussites kills 7 members of the Prague City Council. Now to teach them to not be popular. In 1502, Christopher Columbus lands at Guanaja on the Bay Islands off the coast of Honduras. This was his 4th voyage to the New World. 1609, the Beaver Wars. At Ticonderoga, which is now Crown Point, New York, Samuel du Champlain shoots and kills 2 Iroquois chiefs on behalf of his native allies, which, of course, annoyed the Iroquois no end. In 1619, Jamestown, Virginia, the first colonial European representative assembly in the Americas. It was the Virginia General Assembly, convened for the first time. 1627, an earthquake kills 5,000 people in Gargano, Italy. 1635, 80 Years' War, the Siege of Cinconchans begins. Frederick Henry, Prince of Orange, begins to recapture the strategically important fortress from the Spanish army. 1656, Swedish forces under the command of King Charles X, Gustav, defeat the forces of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth at the Battle of Warsaw. 1676, Nathaniel Bacon issues the Declaration of the People of Virginia. This begins Bacon's Rebellion against the rule of Governor William Berkeley. One of the major leaders of that was one of my ancestors. And basically, he got involved, so he had a chance to shoot his father-in-law. 1729, founding of Baltimore, Maryland. 1733, the first Masonic Grand Lodge in the future of the United States is constituted in Massachusetts. 1756, St. Petersburg. Bartolomeo Rastrelli presents the newly built Catherine Palace to Empress Elizabeth and her courtiers. 1811, Father Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla, leader of the Mexican insurgency, is executed by the Spanish in Chihuahua City, Mexico. That'll teach you to annoy your betters. 1859, first ascent of Grand Combine, one of the highest summits in the Alps. 1863, American Indian Wars. Representatives of the United States and tribal leaders, including Chief Pocatello of the Shoshone, signed the Treaty of Box Elder. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of the Crater. Union forces attempt to break Confederate lines at Petersburg, Virginia by exploding a large bomb underneath their trenches. 1865, the steamboat. Brother Jonathan sinks off the coast of Crescent City, California. Kills 225 passengers. It was the deadliest shipwreck on the Pacific coast of the U.S. at the time. 1866, armed Confederate veterans in New Orleans riot against a meeting of radical Republicans. Killed 48 and injured another 100. 1871, Staten Island Ferry, Westfield's boiler explodes. Kills 85 or more. 1912, Japan's Emperor Meiji dies and is succeeded by his son, Yoshihito, who is now known as the Emperor Taisho. 1930, in Montevideo, Uruguay. in Montevideo, Uruguay wins the first FIFA World Cup. 1932, premiere Walt Disney's Flowers and Trees. The first cartoon short to use Technicolor and the first Academy Award winning cartoon short. 1945, World War II. Japanese submarine I-58 sinks the USS Indianapolis, kills 883 seamen. Most died during the following 4 days as they treaded water, hoping for the best, till an aircraft notices the survivors. 1956, a joint resolution of the U.S. Congress is signed by President Eisenhower, authorizes In God We Trust as the U.S. national motto. 1962, the Trans-Canada Highway, the longest national highway in the world, is officially opened. 1965, President Johnson signs the Social Security Act of 65 into law, establishes Medicare and Medicaid. 1966, England defeats West Germany to win the 1966 FIFA World Cup at Wembley Stadium after extra time. 1969, Vietnam War. Nixon makes an unscheduled visit to South Vietnam and meets with President Nguyen Van Thieu and the U.S. military commanders. 1971, Apollo program. Apollo 15 mission. David Scott and James Irwin on the Apollo Lunar Module Falcon land on the moon with the first lunar rover. 1971, an all-Nippon Airways Boeing 727 and a Japanese Air Force F-86 collide over Morioka, Iwate, Japan, kills 162. 1974, Watergate scandal. Nixon releases subpoenaed White House recordings after being ordered to do so by the Supreme Court of the United States. 1975, Jimmy Hoffa vanishes from the parking lot of the Macha's Red Fox restaurant in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit. He vanished at about 2:30 in the afternoon. He's never been seen or heard from again. Been a lot of rumors about what happened to him. But his body just vanished. 1978. The Okinawa Prefecture changes its traffic on the right-hand side of the road to the left-hand side of the road. 1980. Vanuatu gains independence. 1980. Israel's Knesset passes the Jerusalem Law. 1981. As many as 50,000 demonstrators, mostly women and children, took to the streets and lots to protest food ration shortages in communist Poland. 1990. Ian Gao, conservative member of parliament, assassinated at his home by IRA terrorists in a car bombing after he assured the group that the British government would never surrender to him. 2003, in Mexico, the last old-style Volkswagen Beetle rolls off the assembly line. 2006, the world's longest-running music show, Top of the Pops, is broadcast for the last time on BBC Two. The show had been airing for 42 years. 2011, marriage of Queen Elizabeth II's eldest daughter, eldest granddaughter, Zara Phillips, to former rugby union footballer Mike Tindall. 2012, a train fire kills 32 passengers, injures 27 on the Tamil Nadu Express in Andhra Pradesh, India. 2012, a power grid failure in Delhi leaves more than 300 million people without power in northern India. 2014, 20 killed, 150 are trapped after a landslide in Maharashtra, India. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's talk about holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Abdon and Sinan, Hebron, Maxima, Donatella, Secunda, Peter Chrysologus, Robert Barnes in the Lutheran Church, Rufinus of Assisi, Totwin, Ursus of Auxerre, Solanus Casey, Feast of the Throne in Morocco, Independence Day. That's the independence of Vanuatu from the United Kingdom and France in 1980. International Day of Friendship, internationally. Dia de Amigo in Paraguay, Martyrs Day in South Sudan. There's a okay. Let's see what else we got. You know, it's going to be 106 here today. 1187, Frederick I Barbarossa, Holy Roman Emperor, crowned King of Burgundy. 1419, first defenestration of Prague, anti-Catholic Hussites, followers of executed reformer Jan Hus stormed Prague town hall and throw the judge, mayor, and several city council members out the windows. They either die in the fall or are killed by the crowd outside. 1869, the Charles, the world's first oil tanker, departs from the U.S., headed for Europe with a capacity of 7,000 barrels of oil. 1935, the first Penguin book is published, starting the paperback revolution. 1948, professional wrestling premieres on primetime network TV. 1954, Elvis Presley joined the Memphis Federation of Musicians, Local 71. Everybody had to have a union, you know. Arnold Schwarzenegger, 73. On this date, 500 Marseillaisian men sing France's national anthem for the first time in 1792. In 101 BC, the Battle of Versailles. The Roman army under Gaius Marius defeats the Cimbri in Cisalpine Gaul, ending the Celto-German threat on Italy's border with over 100,000 Cimbri killed. 579, Benedict I ends his reign as the Catholic Pope. 657, St. Vitalian begins his reign as Catholic Pope. He succeeds Eugene I. 762, what you might call the modern city of Baghdad, founded by Abbasid Caliph al-Mansur, just north of the location of the ancient city of Baghdad. Let's see. 1650, Prince of Wilhelm II occupied Amsterdam. 1653, Johan de Witt sworn in as pension advisor of Holland. 1678, English troops land in Flanders. 1715, the Spanish gold and silver fleet vanished off St. Lucie, Florida. 1775, Captain James Cook returned to England. 1836, the first English language newspaper published in Hawaii. 1863, President Abraham Lincoln issued what was called the Eye for an Eye Order. He gave orders to shoot a rebel prisoner for every black prisoner shot. 1864, the Battle of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. It was burned by Union forces under McCausland. 1865, Pope Pius IX visited Suriname. 1866, New Orleans Democratic government orders police to raid an integrated Republican Party meeting. 40 people killed, 150 injured. 1870, the Republic of Klipdrift, proclaimed by Transvaal President Andries Pretorius after the discovery of diamonds in South Africa in 1866. This resulted in a flood of treasure hunters. The Boer Republics contested ownership of the diamond fields. In 1872, Milan Loomis patented wireless telegraphy. All right. 1907, Russia and Japan signed an agreement guaranteeing freedom of China while recognizing each other's special interest. 1907, the French bombard Casablanca and land troops to occupy the Atlantic coast region of Morocco after attacks on foreigners. That was before the French learned how to raise their hands and scream, "We surrender." 1913, on this date, the conclusion of the Second Balkan War. 1914, after initial reluctance, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia was persuaded to decree a general mobilization response to Austria. 1916, German saboteurs blew up a munitions plant on Black Tom Island in New Jersey. 1928, George Eastman, founder of Eastman Kodak, shows the first amateur color motion pictures to guests at his New York house. Among those guests was Thomas Edison, who went on to create quite a few takeoffs of that. 1930, the first broadcast of Death Valley Days on NBC Radio. 1938, General Metaxas names himself Premier of Greece. 1942, FDR signed a bill creating the Women's Navy Auxiliary Agency, also called the WAVES. 1943, U.S. 45th Infantry Division occupies San Stefano. 1946, the first rocket attained 100-mile altitude at White Sands, New Mexico. 1949, the British warship HMS Amethyst escapes down the Yangtze River, having been refused a safe passage by Chinese communists after a 3-month standoff. I saw the movie which starred, I can't think of his name. Played Bullet. It's called The Sandpipers. 1963, British spy Kim Philby found living happily in Moscow. 1965, Duke Ellington's Gold and Brown and the Green Apple premieres. 1966, U.S. airplanes bombed the demilitarized zone of Vietnam. 1969, Barbara Streisand, before she became such a political activist, opened for Liberace at the International Hotel in Las Vegas. I got a chance to tour Liberace's home. He lived it up, let me tell you. 1969, KAEC-TV, Channel 19 in Lufkin, Texas, began broadcasting. I think that's it. We've been talking about strange crimes, and I've got a bunch more for you today. Yes, sir. I got a bedtime story to start out with. Bedtime story that's sure to keep you up at night. Between 1979 and 1983, five young men between the ages of 14 and 25 were kidnapped, drugged, tortured, and murdered in and around the South Australian city of Adelaide. In 1984, Bevan Spencer von Einem, an Adelaide accountant, is convicted of committing one of the murders and is currently serving a life sentence. Last I knew, he is still alive. Although police believe von Einem took part in all the murders, they didn't have sufficient evidence to prove it. An anonymous witness, anonymous because he had been threatened, informed police that while von Einem was guilty, he wasn't alone. Excuse me. He was only one member of a shadowy group of prominent Adelaide citizens that included lawyers and doctors who used their resources to prey on young men. Members of this group, called the family and the press, are believed to have taken part in all five murders, and possibly others with von Einem. Now, he never revealed who his accomplices were, though he hinted that the group was responsible. And he was too afraid of repercussions to provide further information. There's still a $1 million reward for information leading to further convictions. Now, this case was reopened in October 2008, but despite what was supposed to be new evidence, no further arrests have been made, and the case is still open. So if you happen to know who committed those murders, you can make $1 million. Well, sometimes the most brilliant criminal plot backfires, and sometimes it backfires literally. Herbert Ridge built a gas siphoning contraption with an electric pump. One afternoon in October 2012, he was stealing gas from a parked car in East Mesa, Arizona. While he was doing it, the pump sparked and ignited the gasoline that caught his t-shirt on fire. Well, he started rolling around on the street trying to put out the fire, much to the amusement of kids walking home from school. Then he jumped in his pickup truck and sped away. There was only one problem. He was still on fire. And so was his truck. Well, seeing no other alternative, he jumped out of the truck and ran. His pickup truck, still burning, kept on going till it smashed into a house and set the house on fire. Neighbors who saw what happened put out the house fire and apprehended Ridge, who was taken to the hospital, and from there was taken to jail. Doesn't it burn you up when things go bad? In 2001, two men broke into the home of 71-year-old Faye Olson on the Australian island of Tasmania, tied her to a chair and poked her with sticks, and then robbed her of the equivalent of $504. Now, police found no evidence at the scene about this attack except for a leech, fully engorged with blood from a recent meal, lying on the floor. Well, police checked the woman and then themselves for signs the leech had been attached to one of them and determined it must have fallen off one of the robbers. So, DNA samples were taken from the blood in the leech, but nothing came of it. Then 7 years later, in 2008, a 56-year-old Tasmanian man was arrested on drug charges, and a routine DNA sample was taken from him and cross-checked against the database. Well, his blood DNA test matched the DNA taken from the leech. Well, Peter Alec Cannon, who was the 56-year-old Tasmanian man, eventually confessed to being involved in the attack on Faye Olson and was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Now, his accomplice was never named or apprehended. According to Tasmanian police, it's the first time DNA from a leech had assisted in solving a crime anywhere in the world. Well, though forensics is a relatively new official science, it has been centuries in the making. In 1813, Matthew Ofila published the first treatise that systematically catalogs poisons and their effects. From this, he gained the title Father of Modern Toxicology, although there certainly was not an official ceremony. He was also one of the first to develop forensic blood tests and to examine blood and semen with a microscope for forensic purposes. In 1835, Scotland Yard investigator Harry Goddard determined that a butler had staged an attempted robbery when he traced a bullet back to a bullet mole owned by the butler. This is the first example of bullet matching, and frankly, one of the first actual recorded cases of the butler did it. In 1863, a German scientist named Schonbein creates the first presumptive test for blood when he discovers that hemoglobin will oxidize hydrogen peroxide. Mixing peroxide and ketchup will simply give you an edible ketchup. Though it's not clear if Schonbein made this observation. So if the question came down to is it blood or is it ketchup, and you mix a little hydrogen peroxide, if it oxidizes, it's blood. If it doesn't taste well on a hamburger, it's ketchup. 1880. Tokyo. There'd been a burglary and an innocent man was blamed for the heist. Scottish physician and missionary Henry Falls, who used fingerprints not only to clear the accused, but also helped bring the actual criminal to justice. Falls writes about using fingerprints for crime solving in the science journal Nature, and spends the next couple of decades in a nasty letter writing spat with one Sir William Herschel, about which the two of them brought up the idea first. Finally, in 1917, Herschel, not to be confused with the other Sir William Herschel who discovered Uranus, conceded that Folds was first. 1892. Sir Francis Galton of Great Britain publishes Fingerprints, the first book to codify fingerprint patterns and show how to use them to solve crimes. In Argentina, police investigator Juan Vostich developed a fingerprinting classification system based on Galton's work and used it to accuse a mother of murdering her two sons and slitting her own throat to make it look like the work of somebody else. She did everything perfect, except she left bloody fingerprints on a doorpost. Well, that'll teach her. Well, today, Logtown is an overgrown ghost town near Jacksonville, Oregon. But in 1861, it was a thriving mining town. Then tragedy struck. Mary Hinkle and her two daughters, aged 6 and 16, were killed in a fire. Right away, the locals suspected this was more than an accident. It was actually a triple murder. What was the motive, you might ask? There had been rumors that a hoard of gold was hidden somewhere in the Hinkle cabin. During the investigation, a young photographer went to the police and told them the last thing a person sees before death leaves an image on their retinas. Now, with the very concept of photography in its infancy, the idea wasn't so uncanny. So the photographer set up his gear and took photos of the dead woman's eyes. When the plates were processed, well, there was no image of a killer. And in fact, nobody was ever formally charged with the crime. Now, that young man was a Swiss immigrant named Peter Britt. He went on to become one of Oregon's most celebrated citizens. Not only started the grape industry in the Rogue Valley, he was also the first person to photograph what's now Crater Lake National Park. The Brit Music Festival carries on his name, but interestingly enough, there are no cameras allowed at the Brit Music Festival. Okay, let's talk about Facebook felons. You got an individual by the name of Mark Mussarella. He's 46, lives in Staten Island, New York. He was an emergency medical technician with the Richmond University Medical Center. When he was called to an apartment where a 26-year-old woman had been murdered, he, for whatever reason, he took a photograph of the dead body with his cell phone and put it up on his Facebook page. One of Mussarella's friends saw that photo and called the hospital where he worked and reported it. He was immediately fired and arrested. Mussarella, who was formerly a highly decorated NYPD detective, also lost his EMT license. You gotta wonder what motivates people to do incredibly stupid things. Well, let's talk about Paul Franco of Queens, New York. He was 38. In February 2010, he hacked the Facebook account of his ex-girlfriend, Jessica Zamora Anderson. Then he changed her password and held the account hostage, demanding hundreds of dollars to give her the new password. Zamora Anderson had met Franco 16 months before on Facebook. They started dating. Eventually, she found out he wasn't the teacher he said he was, but continued dating him because he claimed he had a tape of them having sex and said he put it on the internet as she left him. Well, eventually, Franco was arrested. Zamora Anderson got her Facebook account back. And it came out that Franco didn't have the sex tape he said he did. You just can't trust some criminals. Well, let's talk about the Cherry Sisters, an Iowa singing group. They sued the Des Moines Register. It was a landmark libel case. At the turn of the century, the Register ran a scathing review of the Cherry Sisters Act. According to the reporter, their long, skinny arms, equipped with talons at the extremities, waved frantically at the suffering audience. And the mouths of their rancid features opened like caverns and sounds like the wailing of the damned issued. Well, outraged and humiliated, the singer sued the newspaper for libel. Well, the judge, being unusually intelligent for a judge, asked the sisters to perform their act for him in court. And after he heard them sing, ruled in favor of the newspaper. Let's talk about Robert Krapinski, 36-year-old Philadelphia real estate manager. He sued the Transcendental Meditation Society and the guru Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. You see, Krapinski worked with the group for 11 years, and he finally sued him because he was never able to achieve that perfect state of life they promised, and as a result of this failure, suffered psychological disorders. One broken agreement that he kept pointing to, he had been told he'd be taught to fly through self-levitation. But he learned only to hop with the legs folded in the lotus position. Well, after hearing both sides, a U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. awarded him $138,000 in damages. Hopping certainly did not classify as flying. So you got to wonder about his gullibility. Well, let's talk about one of the most famous disappearances in history, Judge Joseph Crater. He was the newly appointed justice to the New York Supreme Court and a potential appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, Crater and his wife were vacationing in Maine on August 3rd, 1930, when he got a phone call from New York City. After the call, he was clearly disturbed and announced to his wife he had to go straighten those fellas out. So he left her in Maine and went back to New York City. Well, 9 days later, his wife notified the police and a massive manhunt began. Well, police searched Crater's apartment and didn't find anything suspicious, but as the investigation continued, the police, as well as the public, were astonished to see Crater's carefully constructed facade unravel. It turned out this paragon of virtue, as most judges maintain that they are, kept a number of mistresses and had been seen on the town with showgirls. And most surprising, this paragon of virtue was deeply involved in graft, fraud, and political payoffs. It also seemed as though he'd be implicated in the Ewald scandal that involved paying for a city appointment. And there was even evidence Crater had paid for his own appointment to the bench. Now, some were sure he was murdered by gangster associates, and others noting the judge had removed files containing potentially incriminating evidence from his own office just before he disappeared, speculated that political cronies had killed him to shut him up. Or maybe he committed suicide and watched his career crumble because of scandal. Whatever happened, it was assumed that he was dead. Now, his wife suffered a nervous breakdown and didn't return to their New York apartment until January 1931. When she got there, she found an envelope in the top drawer of her dresser. There was $6,690 in cash, which was quite a lot of money in 1931. It also contained the judge's will, written 5 years before, leaving his entire estate to her, and a 3-page pencil note that listed everybody who owed the judge money. It closed with the words, "I'm very weary, love, Joe." The police had searched the apartment thoroughly, and they kept a 24-hour guard on it since the disappearance, so nobody could imagine how or when that envelope got there. There was one other possibility. Crater had intentionally disappeared. Well, in July 1937, Crater was declared legally dead. His wife collected on his life insurance. By this point in time, the New York police commissioner believed that Crater's disappearance was premeditated. Now, I've read another number of stories of prospectors in the West having met a man leading a burra who claimed to be Judge Crater. Maybe he went prospecting. Who knows? You know, interestingly enough, during the Middle Ages, murdering a traveling musician was not considered a serious crime. They must have anticipated the arrival of rap. Let's talk about what we might refer to as irony in the court. A 1986 court case didn't go well for the Otis Elevator Company. Might have had something to do with the fact that the jury on their way to hear the case got stuck for 20 minutes in an Otis elevator. Similar thing happened to the Pacific Gas and Electric Company in 2000. While on trial for failure to trim vegetation around power lines, a branch fell off a tree and knocked out the power to the courthouse. 1992, the U.S. Postal Service was defending itself against an unemployment discrimination lawsuit. In order to proceed, the defense had to mail a list of expert witnesses from Washington, D.C. to Dayton, Ohio. List was sent via the USPS's overnight express mail delivery service. Wonder of wonders, it didn't get to Dayton for 10 days. And a production company won $1.8 million judgment against a former employee accused of stealing the concept for a TV game show. Name of the stolen show? Anything for Money. Well, let's talk about an interesting thing that happened at the prison on Alcatraz. A prisoner who spent the most time in a notorious prison on Alcatraz in the San Francisco Bay was actually Canadian. Alvin Old Creepy Carpus was born in Montreal in 1908. By his 10th birthday, he had fallen in with a bad crowd that corrupted his morals. He was first arrested for burglary in 1926. Then he got hired into what you might call an entry-level position in the Murderous Barker gang and worked his way up the ladder to what you might call upper management, increasing gang profits by innovating a successful strategy of kidnapping industrials for ransom. Among the victims was William Ham Jr., the Ham Brewing Company. That got him $100,000, the equivalent of about $1.5 million today. And Edward Brimmer, president of a Minnesota bank, he coughed up $200,000, or about $3 million today. And as proof of his commitment to the organization, Carpets had his fingerprints surgically removed so he couldn't be easily traced. Well, in spite of the pain and suffering he endured in the removal of his fingerprints, United States bureaucrats caught him anyway and arrested him in 1936. Sent him briefly to Leavenworth Prison in Kansas and finally to Alcatraz. When Alcatraz closed in 1962, Carpus was transferred to McNeil Island Penitentiary in Washington, where he taught a young Charles Manson, whom he called lazy and shiftless, how to play the guitar. In 1969, he was eventually deported to Canada and said to have died in 1979. Not Manson, but Carpus. You know, one of the best-known scandals in regard to LA police officers was the Rampart scandal. And it involved dozens of LA police officers. Now, Rafael Perez was an officer with the LAPD's Rampart Division. He was also a member of Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH, an elite LAPD anti-gang unit. Well, in 1998, Perez was arrested for stealing 6 pounds of cocaine from an evidence room. He was offered a 5-year sentence and immunity in exchange for testimony against fellow officers. Well, after considering the matter, he agreed to the deal and gave more than 4,000 pages of testimony implicating dozens of his fellow CRASH officers in drug deals, murder, robbery, perjury, and among the robberies he talked about was even a bank robbery, falsification of police reports, extortion, and a laundry list of crimes. Of the 70 officers he implicated, 7 resigned, 12 were suspended, and 5 were fired. Only 7 were tried on criminal charges, and just 3 of those were convicted, and the convictions were later overturned. But the city of Los Angeles ended up paying over $125 million to settle more than 140 civil suits against the city of Los Angeles. Well, in 2000, the CRASH unit was closed down for good. Now, in the investigation, it was discovered at least 3 CRASH officers on the payroll of hip-hop mogul Marion Sugg Knight and his label Death Row Records. 2007, Perez and 2 other Rampart officers were named in a wrongful death lawsuit, alleging they'd carried out a drive-by murder of rapper Notorious B.I.G. Now, that lawsuit was dismissed in 2010, and of course, the murder of Notorious B.I.G. remains unsolved. But could it have been police officers? Well, in the world of organized crime, it's said you can't trust anybody. Joe the Boss Lucero was an old-line Sicilian mob boss whose ultimate goal was to become head of the mafia in New York. Now, not sharing Lucero's dream, though, were younger family members, Luckily Luciano and Vito Genovese. They wanted him out of the picture, as did powerful mobsters Lepke Buckhalter and Oney Madden. When another rival mafioso, Salvatore Maranzano, began to encroach on Masseria's business, Joe the Boss fought back. It was the beginning of a power struggle came known as the Castamarisi War, during which more than 60 men on both sides were killed. Well, Luciano and Genovese secretly contacted Maranzano and offered him a deal. If he'd stopped the bloodshed, they'd whack Masseria. Well, it was a no-lose situation for Maranzano, so he agreed. April 15, 1931, Luciano invited Joe the Boss to the Nuevo Villa Tamaro restaurant, a cheap spaghetti house on Coney Island that he knew
Lucero loved. They ate, played some cards, and Luciano went to the bathroom. Well, while he was in the bathroom, two unknown men walked into the restaurant, fired 20 shots at Masseria, and walked out again. Masseria, of course, died. Luciano took over Masseria's crime family. The Nuevo Villa Tamaro's owner, an Italian immigrant by the name of Gerardo Scarpato, shut down the restaurant and moved back to Italy. 6 months later, he returned to New York. Nobody knows why. And was immediately murdered. No one was ever convicted or even charged with his death. Well, there are judges who should be aware of the old saying, judge not lest you be judged. Dallas County Judge Richard Jones was suspended by the Nebraska Supreme Court after an investigation into 17 complaints concerning his conduct. Judge Jones had taken to signing court documents with names like A. Hitler and Snow White and setting bail amounts in imaginary occurrences. He's also accused of urinating on courthouse carpets, making an anonymous death threat against another judge. He said it was a prank that went wrong, and throwing firecrackers into that judge's office. Judge Jones contested a number of the charges, but admitted he threw the firecrackers. He said, I was just venting. You shouldn't hold it against me. Well, dogged by a state investigation into the claims he was abusive to defendants, Judge Fred Heen announced he wouldn't seek re-election. As an example of Judge Heen's conduct, a woman convicted of a traffic violation asked for more time to complete her community service because she'd been bedridden on doctor's orders during the final week of her pregnancy. Judge denied the request and sentenced her to 44 days in jail. When she protested that she had a 7-day-old baby at home, the judge said, ma'am, you ought to have thought about that a long time ago. Ain't my problem. Well, one thing that's true is there's some odd and outlandish thieves out there. Take, for example, the ones that dressed up as priests. Police in Serbia said three men disguised as Orthodox Christian priests, complete with fake beards and ankle-length cassocks, entered a bank, gave the traditional Christ is born greeting, and then pulled shotguns out of their robes. They walked out with more than $300,000. Then there's the ones that dressed up as cops. On the night of March 18, 1990, two men disguised as cops knocked on the door of the prestigious Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Security guard on duty let them in and were immediately overpowered by the thieves. Thieves made off for several paintings of Vermeer and Manet and three Rembrandts, among other masterpieces, worth about $300 million, give or take. Still ranks as the largest art theft in U.S. history, and it's never been solved, and none of the paintings have ever been recovered. Well, police in Canada announced in 2004 they'd finally caught the Black Panties Bandit. The Black Panties Bandit had robbed at least five convenience stores wearing a black pair of women's underwear over his face as the disguise. It shows imagination. But if they are thick panties, you can't see. And if they're too thin, they can see you. Well, on February 21st, 2012, a man attempted to trick the employees of a Denny's restaurant in Madison, Wisconsin. According to the police report, it was considered a disturbance. Happened at 4:32 p.m. on February 21st, 2012. James B. Summers, age 52, of Madison, Wisconsin, was arrested for fraud, disorderly conduct, possession of drug paraphernalia, and possession of an electric weapon. The victim was female, 38 years old. Mr. Summers announced he was one of the pros from Dover. But the briefcase-toting gentleman wearing a maroon tie and a long black trench coat was quite clear. He'd been sent by corporate. He claimed he was the new general manager. He worked for the restaurant chain for 30 years, and he was starting his new job right now. Well, the victim was in the process of counting the day's receipts at the Denny's on Theater Road, and she had heard nothing from corporate about a new general manager. He said, well, it was final, and he was going to commence his duties right now. At this point, the manager began making calls up the chain. She finally able to reach the man in charge of all hiring at her location. By this time, the new GM had left the office with the bank deposit, but not the restaurant. And she had shut the office door to make this call. Well, on the phone, she waved off kitchen staff as they rapped on the door trying to get her attention. She was not going to be interrupted while talking with corporate. What the staff wanted her to know is the new general manager was cooking a cheeseburger and fries for himself and had gotten himself a soda. Well, he was in the midst of enjoying his meal when she walked up and let him know the gig was up. She had talked to corporate and he was not the general manager. She called 911. When the responding officer got there, he saw the suspect walking away from the restaurant. When the police stopped him, he said there'd been a misunderstanding. He was the new GM, but there must have been a paperwork goof. Well, the manager prevailed, and the man was arrested. The police found underneath the man's trench coat and suit jacket, he was carrying a stun gun. The officer asked if the suspect had a concealed weapons permit, and he said, it's in the pipeline. He was cooperative with the officer, but as he's being led from the restaurant, he yelled out to all those eating there, this is why you don't dine and dash, kiddies. Well, let's talk about dumb crooks of the Old West. The year was 1890. The town was Coffeyville, Kansas. Bob Emmett and Grattan Dalton, along with two other men, formed a gang of outlaws. And they wanted a big payoff and the fame that went with it. And that could only come from what you might consider a legendary bank heist. Well, they planned it all out, but a few things went wrong. See, they planned to rob two banks at once. Two men would rob the First National Bank, and three others would hit Condon & Company right across the street. They thought they'd get double the loot, but actually they only doubled their chances of getting caught. Instead of traveling to another town where nobody knew them, they chose Coffeyville while everybody knew them. Well, the street in front of the banks was being repaired the day that they decided to pull off the robbery, and they could have postponed it, but they went ahead anyway. They had to hitch up their horses a block away, making the getaway a little bit more difficult. And they wore disguises. The disguises were wispy stage mustaches and goatees. Well, the townspeople saw the Dalton boys coming, and everybody grabbed their guns. They did manage to get $20,000 from First National, but at Condon & Company, they came up empty. When they came out of the bank, an angry mob was waiting for them in the street. Hail of bullets greeted them, killed every member of the gang except Emmett Dalton, who went to prison. He came out of the penitentiary to discover the Dalton gang's story had been immortalized. Not as legendary outlaws, but as hopeless screw-ups. Well, you know, in the early 1990s, Pablo Escobar became the richest known criminal in the world. That doesn't count, folks, in government who don't consider themselves criminals, but who steal everything to get their hands on. He was making nearly $1 million a day, providing the United States with 80% of its cocaine. Well, sometimes things aren't what they appear to be. In 2007, a professional arm wrestler named Arsen Lelev tried to qualify for a lower and easier weight class at a European tournament by sending a lookalike to the weigh-in. Lee was caught when officials noticed his lookalike actually didn't look like him at all. In July 2007, Florida passed a law that made it a crime to be a fake band. Singing groups from the 1950s and 60s were touring the casino in elderly heavy state, but people who paid to see the Drifters were really watching a band with one or two replacement members and a bunch of hired singers. Legislation was introduced by John Bowser Ballman of the group Shanana, which actually makes a career out of singing other people's songs. Well, Molly Brustar, secretary at the Catholic Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, put fake names on her employer's payroll and issued checks to herself. And then she used the money to fly to another state, Utah, where she charged dental work and cosmetic surgery to the diocese. And why would doctors allow Brustar to charge her services to the church? Well, it seems that she dressed up as a nun. And when asked why she did this more than once, she said, well, it just became a habit. Well, in October 2017, a 26-year-old Portland, Oregon man named Jason Schaefer caught the attention of police after purchasing bomb-making materials. When a federal officer confronted him at a probation meeting, he ran to his SUV and drove home. Only found more feds waiting for him at his house, so he fled again, this time with several squad cars in pursuit. When they finally caught up with him and surrounded his vehicle, he held up a lighter and a small bomb and yelled, "We're all dying today." Then he detonated the device, which caused, according to the police affidavit, a federal officer to be struck by glass and by the flesh from Schaefer's mangled left hand. So in addition to the explosive and evading police charges, Schaefer was actually charged with assault. Well, in police parlance, a yard bird is a suspect who's caught while hiding in the bushes. Just thought you'd like to know that. Let's talk about the story behind some of the longest recorded prison sentences ever served in modern history. July 26, 1911, Goodell, who was 17, broke into the hotel room of 73-year-old William Jackson. Goodell, who'd been living on his own since he was 14, had worked in the hotel as a bellhop, but he'd been fired. Rumor had it that Jackson, a retired Wall Street broker, kept a lot of cash in his room. So Goodell jumped the older man while he slept and suffocated him, probably unintentionally, with a chloroform-soaked rag. Turned out the rumor was wrong. Goodell found just $7. He was arrested 15 hours later. He got a prison sentence of 20 years to life. 1974, after serving almost 69 years in prison, Goodell was finally granted parole. Only problem was, he didn't want to go. He was eventually convinced to leave in 1980 at the age of 86. It remains the longest time served in U.S. prison history. And then in 1945, two women were murdered in Chicago. At the scene of the second crime, the killer wrote a message on the wall in lipstick. "For heaven's sakes, catch me before I kill him again. I can't control myself." And this led to the press dubbing him the Lipstick Killer. Then in 1946, a 6-year-old Chicago girl was killed and dismembered. Herons, just 17, was arrested and confessed to the crimes. So he was sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms. He died March 5, 2012, at the age of 83 in the 65th year of his sentence. During his time in prison, he became the first Illinois prison inmate to earn a 4-year college degree. Now, he didn't get a trip when he graduated, but what can I say? Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll have more strange crimes to discuss tomorrow evening. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.